Internet Talk Radio, town crier to the global village.
From San Francisco, welcome to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, with your interview host, Dr. Moira Gunn.
Basically, a proton has a positive charge. So if you put a positive charge or a charge in a field, an electric field, you can accelerate it. And in fact, the supercollider consists of not just one accelerator, but in fact, five separate accelerators.
Pushing the edge of science, the supercollider will enable mankind to take the next step. Like an ever more powerful microscope, we will be able to look inside the smallest particle that can be observed today. What is the supercollider, and when will it be complete? Moira speaks with Dr. Tony Montgomery, Director of Research and Technology Applications at the Superconducting Supercollider Laboratory in Dallas, Texas. While the supercollider represents the scientific frontier in particle physics, the technology frontier presses ever forward.
The other major things going on top of all this at a lower technology level is the number of transistors we're cramming into a chip. So that a 386 that had 275,000 transistors on it was quadrupled practically to the 486, which had 1.2 million transistors on it. The Pentium processor has over 3.1 million transistors.
John McIntyre is an architecture manager for Intel Corporation. He talks about the massive evolution of computer chips in the last 10 years, as well as the new breakthrough Pentium processor. And now, here's Moira with Dr. Tony Montgomery.
What is the superconducting supercollider?
The supercollider is a very large proton accelerator that may move science a giant step closer to understanding why the universe contains the kinds of matter it does and why matter has the familiar but unexplained properties, particularly mass. You could say that it is the Apollo program for the 90s, but this time it is not the outer space of the solar system that beckons, but the inner space of the atom.
I've heard such things as the supercollider being described much like a microscope. Tell me what that means.
That's a pretty good description in many respects. The supercollider is, in fact, a superfine microscope that permits us to explore a world of such small dimensions that it is beyond our imagination. A virus, for example, the common cold, is of the order of 1/10 of a millionth of a meter in size. A quark, three of which make up a proton, the smallest nucleus of any atom, the hydrogen atom, is 100 billion times smaller. The supercollider will be able to explore whether in fact quarks are fundamental indivisible particles or whether quarks are made up of even smaller particles. You may have heard the rhyme, big fleas have little fleas on their backs to bite them. Little fleas have lesser fleas, and so ad infinitum. A key question is whether there are smaller fleas than quarks. One other thing I'd like to add there, the supercollider, in addition to being a superfine microscope, is also a time machine in that it transports us back in time and creates conditions that existed in the universe less than 1/1,000,000th of a second after the Big Bang, or the beginning of our universe.
Now, how can that be?
Well, at that point in time, there were no molecules or atoms. When we have a collision of the protons in the supercollider, we generate a whole lot of other particles, many of which don't occur in the Earth naturally. They do occur in stars, and they did occur at the time of the Big Bang, so that we are in the explosion situation or in the collision situation, we are creating those sort of conditions.
Well, I think part of this is that if I look at electron microscopes, which are that 1/100,000,000 of that we see, and that lets us observe DNA. And then we move up to the particle accelerator, which is 1/100,000,000,000th, which lets us see protons with three quarks inside. What is the level that the supercollider is letting us see, and what do you think we'll see?
Well, basically, in a light microscope, we were able to see something because we illuminate it, and our eye is able to see the light that is made up of particles called photons that is either reflected from or transmitted by the object. We see particles in the collider by effectively illuminating one lot of particles with another lot of particles coming in the other direction. It would be difficult and prohibitively expensive to have an accelerator in a straight line for the type of particles we want to use and the energies we want to obtain. That's why the supercollider is in fact a circle or a racetrack. The supercollider is about 54 miles in circumference. It encircles the city of Waxahachie, Texas, which is about 25 miles south of Dallas. In fact, the supercollider, there's a highway around Dallas, so-called LBJ Freeway, and it's roughly the size of the LBJ Freeway. It's a tunnel 150 feet underground. It's about 14 feet in diameter. Inside that tunnel are two evacuated stainless steel tubes, about 2 inches in diameter, which are contained in structures that are cooled down by liquid helium to temperatures of minus 450 degrees Fahrenheit, or about 4 degrees above absolute zero. Within these tubes, beams of protons, the nuclei of hydrogen, circle around in opposite directions.
So in one tube, they're going in one direction, and in the other tube, they're going in the other direction.
Exactly. And each of these beams is only about 5 microns in diameter, or about half the width of a human hair. And the protons, in fact, make 3,500 circuits around this 54-mile racetrack in 1 second. They're traveling at almost within a millionth of 1% of the speed of light, but even more significantly, at their maximum energy of 20 trillion electron volts, their mass, due to relativity, has increased more than 20,000 times their mass when stationary. And then, at a few points around this racetrack, the two proton beams going in opposite directions are brought together and they collide. In these collisions, many new subnuclear particles are formed, which go in every direction. There'll be the order of 100 million collisions a second. The two major detectors that are the eyes of the supercollider, so to speak, are really massive devices. They're located in underground halls, which are the size of football fields. If you parked a truck next to one of the detectors, the truck looks tiny, and the detectors weigh of the order of 36,000 tons. By recording these collisions and deducing information as to the energy, charge, and type of all these particles, one can begin to understand much more about the fundamental parts of matter.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to TechNation, Americans in Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. Tony Montgomery. He is Director of Research and Technology Applications for the Supercollider, which we're talking about today. Now, I have a couple of questions here. The first is that it absolutely boggles my mind that these two-inch tubes are circling in a circumference of 54 miles. Around an entire city. It's like a racetrack, but you can't sit there and just look. You can look at a racetrack. You have to go pretty high to look at this circumference of 54 miles. What is the distance across?
The distance across is around about 17 miles, 18 miles.
Okay, so you've got a big circle, and I assume that those have to be very flat and all very cushioned, and they're the low temperatures, so we're talking a very controlled situation, and there's vacuum inside those tubes.
Yes, the tubes have to be evacuated, and as I said, the tunnel is 150 feet underground, so the tunnel and the distance between the tunnel and the surface varies. So the tunnel is sort of a straight line or a plane, where the ground may be undulating above it. In fact, the supercollider goes under a lake at one point.
Yeah. Now, what are the tubes made of?
The tubes are made of stainless steel, but that really is just a means of controlling the environment. They have to be evacuated, and one also needs to have these superconducting magnets and so on, which are used to bend the protons around the racetrack. If we didn't have these magnets, the protons would just go straight. But to bend them around the racetrack, we need to have, in fact, a total of 10,000 superconducting magnets.
So that we've got these two tubes, and there's protons moving around in them. And to keep the protons in, because they'd go straight, and I guess straight through the tubes, you have electromagnets, 10,000 of them, all the way around the circumference.
Yes, that's correct. And those are cooled down to, the tubes are inside the magnets, in the center of the magnets. The magnets surround the tube.
Oh.
So the magnets bend, because the protons have a positive charge, as they go through the field of the magnets, their path is changed slightly. So they're bent as they go round. So they're kept in this racetrack situation very accurately. I mean, they go very accurately in the middle of the tube. We can't let them stray more than a small fraction.
But they're really affected by that magnetic field more than the outside of the tube. I keep thinking they're bouncing off the side of the tube.
Oh, no.
Incorrect.
Not at all. It's a 5-micron beam right in the middle of the tube.
How do you get the protons to go from rest to zipping around 3,500 circuits per second?
Well, basically, a proton has a positive charge. So if you put a positive charge or a charge in a field, an electric field, you can accelerate it. And in fact, the supercollider consists of not just one accelerator, but in fact, five separate accelerators. We start off with a LINAC, which is a linear accelerator, which accelerates the protons up to about what is called 400 MeV, or 400 million electron volts. And in fact, I should add there that the LINAC, at least we will have a medical facility associated with that LINAC, a proton therapy unit, and that will use protons that are accelerated in the LINAC for therapy purposes to treat patients. But then the protons come out of the LINAC and they go into first a low energy booster, which is a circular booster, then a medium energy booster, then a high energy booster, and then they finally go into the supercollider ring itself. And in the supercollider ring itself, they're accelerated from 2 trillion electron volts to 20. So it goes up a factor of 10 in energy in that final loop.
And how do you boost? How do you get them to move faster? They're going through each of these. Do you turn on a light? Push a button?
No, well, you have an electric field, which effectively, and under the force in an electric field, the particle is accelerated. And in fact, the reason why we use a circular device rather than a linear device is that in a circular device, we only have, in fact, one portion on the loop that actually accelerates the particles. And the reason for that is, as I said earlier, the particles actually are going around this loop 3,500 times every second. And every time they go past the accelerator or the electric field situation, they're given a kick, so to speak. And it takes about an hour and about 12 million kicks to get them to go, to get them to go from the 2 trillion electron volts to 20 trillion electron volts.
So the concept is you a proton going through with the presence of an electric field gets agitated, heats up or agitates and starts to accelerate. So you keep applying it, if you will, through the electric field, and it'll go faster and faster up until the ultimate 20 trillion electron volts that we see.
Right. Although I wouldn't say agitates. You're accelerating it, and you're trying, in fact, not to get it agitated at all. You're trying to get it just accelerated and going in around in a very controlled way.
Now we've gotten these guys. I'm calling the protons guys. So just a little technical term for me.
Well, they could be gals as far as we know.
They could be gals, these guys and gals. And this would really complicate the science. But we've got the guys going around in one direction, and you've got the gals coming around in the other direction. And then at some point, you say, okay, great, we're going to, and I'm making this up here, we're going to have them hit into each other.
Right.
Direct them into each other. So are they suddenly directed into each other? I mean,
no. There are several points in the ring where, in fact, the two rings sort of come together. And, in fact, there are crossover points. So the two beams cross over, and in the crossover region, there will be collisions. But although there are 100 million collisions, because of the numbers of protons that there are in the ring, you can continue having collisions for a long period of time, and there are 100 million collisions occur every second. Now, one of the important things is, in this sort of situation, although there are 100 million collisions a second, only a few of those collisions, of the order of 100, are probably of interest. Most of them are uninteresting. They don't have new particles or new things happening. And one of the real tricks in this type of high-energy physics is to be able to detect the collisions that are possibly of significance. And those are the ones that we record for subsequent later study. But we need to have a pretty sophisticated electronic and computer systems for deciding which of these 100 million collisions are sufficiently significant to record. Because basically, recording one collision takes a megabyte of data. Now, if you have a personal computer, you have probably a 40 megabyte or a 60 megabyte or maybe a 100 megabyte hard disk. A 100 megabyte hard disk, you could record 100 collisions, which is a second's worth in terms of our situation. So we're recording tremendous amounts of data and part of this, that's another thing that we're working on, because there'll be spin-offs in that regard as well, in terms of the amount of data we're handling it, how we handle it, how we record it. So there's a lot of things that are happening with the supercollider, which are happening while we're building it, because we have to develop technologies on quite a number of different fronts to get to the point where the collider is actually working in operation.
We know large technology projects usually spawn sub-technologies. Has there already been some instances of technology transfer here?
Oh, yes, very much so, and it's going on all the time. One of the most significant things is the superconducting magnets that I talked about earlier. Superconducting magnets are used in nuclear magnetic resonance, or MNR equipment, which are basically used to look inside the human body. It's a scanning technique. You may have heard of it.
Yeah.
They use superconducting magnets. We've developed on the supercollider the superconducting wire, and because of the quantities we're using, we've pushed down the price of the superconducting wire. This will reduce the price of things like these medical instruments and make them more broadly applicable to other things. The magnets themselves are reduced in cost because we're manufacturing such a large number of them, and this gives industry the opportunity to
incorporate them into products.
And reduce costs. Another instance, which is a little bit further afield, is in terms of radiation-resistant plastics. Radiation-resistant plastics are needed, in fact, in the detectors. But they're also, we have developed a technique to prevent the plastics from yellowing and discoloring under the bombardment of high-energy particles. Now, you might say, well, what use is that? But, in fact, plastics are used quite a lot in medicine. And one of the problems with plastics is, of course, sterilization. And we can sterilize by using high-energy gamma rays. One reason why we might want to do that is, in fact, ordinary sterilization techniques use a lot of noxious chemicals and is environmentally disadvantageous. So there are some significant advantages, in fact, in using gamma ray sterilization. But if we use it on plastics, we have this problem with plastics becoming yellow and discoloring and becoming brittle as well. We've developed plastics for which this doesn't happen. So it will have applications in the medical field.
Mm.
In parallel computing, we're doing a lot of work. We've linked up 60-plus high-powered workstations, which are connected with optical fibers, 100 megabits per second. And this system has a power many times the power of supercomputers at a fraction of the cost. We're working with several industrial companies on this situation. So there are a lot of areas. There are many others I could talk about. We already have about 45 inventions. We've applied for about 10 patents on various aspects of the things that we've developed for the supercollider.
So just in building the supercollider, technology has moved forward.
Oh, very much so. Even on some fronts that you might not think about, because, for example, in tunnel boring machines, the Robbins Company have developed an inchworm tunnel boring machine specifically for the SSC, and they have certain patents on that machine. That machine, although it was developed for the SSC, is applicable to a lot of other projects across the U.S. and around the world, and this will help in again with U.S. industry.
My guest today is Dr. Tony Montgomery. He is Director of Research and Technology Applications for the Superconducting Supercollider. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn. Now, Dr. Montgomery, how much will the supercollider cost, and who will pay for it?
The budget at the moment, and this is in a little bit of a state of flux, as I'm sure you are aware, relative to things you read in the newspapers and so on. The current budget is, in fact, just a little over $8.2 billion. Of that, of the order, $1.6 billion has already been spent. Of the $8.2 billion, about $1 billion is coming from the state of Texas. We expect to attract or to get another $1.7 billion in contributions from other countries, a big contribution, for example, from Japan. So if you look at the situation, we've essentially, if we stick with the present budget, it would take about between $4 and $5 billion of federal funds to finish the supercollider.
Once it's built, when will it be finished, and who'll be able to use it?
At the moment, as I said earlier, there's some uncertainty relative to the budget situation. We have been asked by the Clinton administration to look at an extension of the project, to extend the completion date by about 2 or 3 years. We were looking at completing the supercollider in 1999. It would be turned on in 1999. Now we're looking at a 2 to 3 year extension beyond that period of time. As to who will use it, basically in the high energy physics field, colliders of this sort are used by international groups from all over the world. There would be U.S. universities using it. There would be universities from many other countries, national labs, and so on. It's very much an international project, both when we get to the point of the supercollider operating and, in fact, at this stage. For example, of the order of 10 to 15% of the people at the supercollider now are from abroad. We have an international community here.
All satellites and rocket motors and aircraft engines, which are to be used in the United States, are tested at Arnold Engineering Development Center in Tullahoma, Tennessee. And they usually run these tests at night and pull all the electricity that the Tennessee Valley Authority can muster. It's magnificent to see these things running. When the supercollider runs, will there be a large drain of electrical resources?
This, as you might imagine, it was one of the key planning factors for the SSC, because it does use a lot of electric power. And we work very closely in the planning phases with TU Electric on this question. The SSC effectively runs continuously, so we really don't have the option of nighttime operation. Most of the power is used in the cryogenic systems, or keeping the ring at liquid helium temperatures. And we'll need about 200 megawatts of power to keep the supercollider in operation. But this is only about 1% of TU Electric's 20,000 megawatt generating capacity. So I think we're in good shape from that standpoint.
And TU Electric is Texas?
Texas Utilities.
Texas Utilities. We didn't know that out here. Does it make noise when it runs?
No, it doesn't. It does, except
this
for
is all a trick. You're not really running those protons around.
Well, the protons are in a vacuum, and in fact, I don't know whether at high school you're sometimes shown in science class a bell, electric bell in a bell jar, and as you take the air out of the bell jar, you stop hearing the bell itself. The protons are actually going around in a vacuum. So there's no sound as far as the protons are concerned, but there are noises from things like fans, from electronics, and noises from pumps and compressors and that sort of thing. But basically, it's pretty quiet.
So it's the support equipment that's making what noise there is.
Right, exactly.
As opposed to the super collider itself.
Exactly.
Now, this is going under interstates and under lakes and under land that I'm assuming that people live on or would walk across or drive across. Is there anything harmful that would be given off by the super collider?
No, it does not give off anything that is any way harmful at the surface, even in the very unlikely event of some type of accident. However, as at other high-energy physics accelerator facilities, no one will be allowed in the tunnel when the SSC is actually in operation. I mean, we are generating high-energy particles and so on, and that's one reason for having the super collider underground. But there's absolutely no risk at all at the surface.
You were mentioning earlier these computers that take data in and collect the data and sort it out. Are these specially designed for the super collider, or are these just specially assembled of off-the-shelf parts, if you will?
Well, basically, in many respects, we are using off-the-shelf parts, at least to some degree. I mentioned that we had the order of 64 workstations, and these together give us a power considerably higher than supercomputers. But the cost is very much lower because these are mass-produced and so on and so forth. They're connected. Some of the things we're doing in connecting them is pushing the state of the art. And we're working with several companies on things in that regard. But basically, we do require tremendous computer capability, both in recording all the information, in analyzing it. We need a lot of computer storage capability because we're recording all this information.
Are there many super colliders being built?
We're basically one of a kind. There are probably about a dozen colliders of various sorts around the world. The biggest proton collider, apart from the supercollider, is the Tevatron at Fermilabs in Illinois. That is about a 20th of the power of the supercollider. So there are a lot of things that we'll be able to do with the supercollider that can't be approached with regard to the Tevatron at Fermilab, so that it really is a tremendous step up in capability, one that we hope will bring us to the point that we can tackle and begin to understand some of the key questions in physics, which ultimately will help us to apply these things to everyday life and will make a difference in the future.
Moira's first guest has been Dr. Tony Montgomery, Director of Research and Technology Applications at the Superconducting Supercollider Laboratory. You're listening to TechNation, Americans and Technology with Dr. Moira Gunn. Based in Santa Clara, California, Intel Corporation is the world's largest manufacturer of computer chips. John McIntyre is an architecture manager for Intel, and he speaks with Moira about the new groundbreaking Pentium processor chip.
It's the next generation chip from Intel, and maybe I first can explain the nature of the name. A lot of people expect us to go to 586, and we chose not to go to that naming or keep on the current naming train we were on. Penta is Greek for 5, so we are retaining that fifth generation part. And the EM comes from like the periodic chart of elements. We want people to view the Pentium processor as an important ingredient in their personal computer. Therefore, we came up with Pentium processor.
People have personal computers, and they say, what do you got in there? You got a 386, or what do you got in there? And if we go back, there were 8088s and 8086s, and then they got a 286, and then a 386, and a 486.
Right.
And as you say, we don't have a 586, we have a Pentium. Can you just take your time and describe for us each of those progressions?
Well, I can outline the major architectural differences as we progressed on. The 8088 or 8086 was the first processor that was adopted by IBM in 1982. And that was a 8-bit, so-called 8-bit processor, 8-bit referring to the address data path. Okay. The next major revolution came in about 1985 or 84, I should say, when the 8286, referred to as the Intel 286, came out, and that was a so-called 16-bit architecture. So you got more performance out of it because you had 16-bit data path and address path instead of just 8 bits like the old 8086. So you got more performance, essentially. The next big jump in the architecture came as we went from 286 to 386 in 1985. That was a so-called 32-bit architecture. So we're doubling in time.
Now let me just stop you right
okay.
there. And people say, well, how does that make you faster? And the point is you've got to get data from the memory up to the processor, to the brain, if you will, to chunk
right.
on it. And if it's an 8-bit path, it will take you twice as long to bring data up and programs up to the processor than if it's a 16-bit path. And
right.
it will take you four times as long, you know, at 32 bits. So widening that path was really big for speed.
That's correct, and that's just one of the architectural features, but it's the most commonly talked about. Also, going from the 286 to 386, there were some major architectural changes made in how the processor operates, and without going into a lot of the detail, we created this thing called virtual memory. So an address, you can address to real memory, which is real memory out there in chips somewhere, and then we came up with this concept of virtual memory. And, of course, virtual gets a lot of talk these days with things like virtual reality. But it was just a trick, essentially, we played so we can address more memory. So that was another major architectural enhancement from 286 to 386 that not only increased performance, which is important, but also functionality. A lot of today's software we're used to using is based on DOS, which is a 16-bit operating system, but taking advantage of a lot of the functionality of the 386. So that kind of became the baseline back in the late, mid-80s, the 386 architecture. Going on from the 386, we essentially draw a baseline, and the architecture is stabilized to some degree, you might say, as we went on to 486 and now the Pentium processor. The 486 came out in 1989, and that was the major architectural changes from the 386 was not to change the data path or the address path. It's a 32-bit processor, okay, also. But we increased performance by adding some other tricks to get performance up, so-called RISC design techniques. Now, I think most people have heard of RISC processors versus CISC processors.
Well, I think you're going to have to explain it.
Well, the I don't want to get too much into detail. CISC is complex
instruction
set. And RISC is reduced instruction set. The basic concept of RISC was make your instructions smaller so that they can be executed faster. With the Intel architecture, which was an older architecture, the so-called CISC architecture, we had more complex instructions that could do more things, but they were slower to execute. What we did with the 486, coming from the 386, we actually used some of those RISC design techniques. We so-called hardwired some of those complex instructions, so we didn't have to run them out of software anymore. We could run them hardwired and hardware and get the performance up. So what you saw going from the Intel 386 to the 486 was another doubling in performance at the same clock speed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Go ahead.
Now, what I'm about to say is just to revisit for those of you people who are saying, gee, I'm not exactly sure, is just remember in your PC, the classic idea of how it operates is that you've got data and instructions sitting down in memory, and you've got a processor up there that executes those instructions. Now, the harder those instructions are to execute, the longer they're going to take. So if we can break those down into simpler instructions, in fact, if they're a fast instruction, you might be able to get a whole lot more together. And so the areas in which you can improve performance is how big your memory is to hold data and programs, which was the 286 to 386 leap, that's big, the path between memory and the processor, and what's in the processor and how fast it can execute those instructions. So in general, Intel's been tweaking and tweaking and tweaking, and that's where we are now with the 486. There was a smaller instruction set that could execute faster and return, in general, a faster performance.
Yeah, at the instruction set level, it hasn't changed from the 386 to the 486. We actually added just a few instructions to do things like multiprocessing.
Oh, really?
Okay, right. So we haven't changed the instruction set, and that's the most important thing about the Intel architecture, is all that software that's been written all the way back to 1982 still runs, because we have the same instruction set, essentially. Okay.
So you've increased the number of instructions.
Well, we've really, a few, I mean, we've really kind of topped off, and we've just added a few instructions to handle things like multiprocessing, which is a coming thing for the desktop, but you see it a lot at the server level today.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the major architectural change in the 486, though, was our ability to take some of these RISC design techniques to get the performance up by hardwiring some of those instructions. Okay, we didn't eliminate them. The other major things going on top of all this at a lower technology level is the number of transistors we're cramming into a chip. That's just really driven this whole microcomputer industry, and that's why we're, you know, working, chipping away at the mini computer and the mainframe, and while those businesses are kind of going away, that we can produce more performance, more MIPS at essentially the same cost or lower cost. So that a 386 that had 275,000 transistors on it was quadrupled practically to the 486, which had 1.2 million transistors on it. The Pentium processor has 3.1 million transistors. So at a lower technology level, we got a bigger transistor budget, as we say, so we can increase performance and functionality. So also on the 486, we did things like put cache right on board. There's 8K cache on board. And we put a floating point unit right on board, whereas with the 386, you had to buy a separate chip to get that. So
correct.
That was the big changes from 386 to 486. And the bottom line, what the user saw was essentially a doubling in performance at the same clock speed. So if you had a 386 that ran at, say, 33 megahertz, and now you had a 486 at, say, 33 megahertz, you saw about double performance at the chip level. Now, when you look at a system level performance, there's other things like disk speed and I/O and video performance and so on. So,
at any rate, well, we're going to go back and define all of those things. We're going to talk about all of that stuff. But independent of just reorganizing and getting smarter and that type of thing, at a whole lower level, the chips we were able to manufacture, just like as time marches on, we're able to get more transistors and more little guys that do things into that same small size chip. And even if we hadn't done anything to the architecture, we would have seen increased performance.
Right. Just having more transistors to do more things is really the underlying technology to semiconductor business and why it's been so successful.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Dr. Moira Gunn, and my guest today is John McIntyre. He is an architecture manager for Intel Corporation, and we're talking about the new Pentium microprocessor. Now, John, let's look a little differently. You were saying earlier, MIPS. Let's talk about that. I was reading here the 66 megahertz version of the Pentium operates 112 V1.1 drystone MIPS with a spec into 92 rating of 64. I can go on and on.
Right.
Let's talk about MIPS.
Okay. Well, MIPS is, or the other one you referred to is spec integer, which is an industry standard way of measuring performance of the microprocessor. That's all they are. They're just measurements of performance. And then, as I was saying before, what our goal at Intel is deliver much higher performance at the same or lower price as time goes. So we were talking about the 486 a second ago, and that is commonly, the MIPS rating we commonly refer to is something in the range of 40 to 50 MIPS based on how fast the processor
and
is.
MIPS is million instructions per second.
Right.
So the 486 rating is what?
Depending on the speed, 40 to 50 MIPS.
Okay. 40 to 50 million
right.
instructions per second.
Correct.
And that's slow.
Oh, I don't think it's slow. It's okay today.
That's a joke.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's funny because if you look back at some of the first 386s to come out, they were 4 or 5 MIPS type ratings. So we jumped up in 2 or 3 years to 40 to 50 MIPS. Now with the Pentium processor, we're looking at 100 and above MIPS. So we're doubling the performance as we go out in time here.
How much does a Pentium processor chip cost, and I know that, you know, volumes, all this kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
versus, say, a 486 processor?
We haven't released the pricing yet. At the end of May, we're going to release the pricing and availability for the Pentium processor. At the end of March, we did release the technical specifications, but pricing isn't available yet.
So you can't make any predictions?
No, I mean, if somebody's trying to get an idea, and, you know, our customers are the system manufacturers, our direct customers, and if you go back and look at what a 486 was in 1989 when we first introduced it, you might get an inkling or a guess, but that is not to say that that's the kind of pricing structure we'll use again. One of the major things happening at Intel is that we're accelerating our cycle of bringing microprocessors to the market. So you're going to see more processors coming out faster than ever from Intel. So that pushes prices down faster also. That's the good news for the consumer.
Well, one has to suspect that there will be some kind of a price break, and that Albert Yu, who's Senior Vice President and General Manager of the Microprocessor Products Group, has said the Pentium processor will enable the best price performance systems in the marketplace over any other processor, and that just the prices per MIPS has got to be pretty good.
Yeah, I guess I would just add on to Albert's comment there. I think this year in 1993, for the consumer who wants the very best price performance, you're still looking at a 486-based system. Now, it may be a 486-based system that's upgradable to a Pentium processor through our overdrive technology, which is an upgrade chip. But we're building tens of millions of 486s every year, as opposed to this year we'll build tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of Pentium processors. So as far as amortizing cost, I think you'll see the Pentium processor being, you know, the mainstay processor probably in 1993-94 time period.
Because the applications people and the systems people have put them all together, still have to catch up with this new technology.
Yeah, they have to catch up with it. And Intel just, you know, as we introduce a new generation of processors, it takes a couple of years before we're into very high volume, tens of millions. To us, tens of millions is high volume production.
When a new chip is designed and manufactured, there is what is called a honeymoon period. Tell us about the honeymoon period.
I guess that kind of gets at the heart of marketing our technology as opposed to just the technology itself. And it is true some people have come along and tried to imitate our chips. Some of them have tried to do direct copies, okay? And we've been very successful stopping them from doing that through legal channels, because we have patents and intellectual property rights that prevent that. Other people have done not direct copies, but perhaps a processor that does very much of what our processor does, okay, but maybe not 100%, and market it in that way. And, you know, people are free to try to do that if they want to. One of the motivations for us naming the Pentium processor that instead of the Intel 586 is that we weren't unable to prevent people from naming their processors 386 or 486 or whatever because we couldn't patent those numbers or copyright those numbers. So we had a real problem in the marketplace where people think they're getting an Intel, say, 486, and they're not. They're getting somebody else's I wouldn't say copy, but imitation.
46 John.
Yeah, some attempt at making what a 46 is. And if you look at these performance numbers like we were talking about before, essentially what's out there in the market today is 386-type processors that people call 46. So that's, I guess, the way you work at the honeymoon period is we're always moving ahead. And of course, we're going to protect our intellectual property rights.
Intel, which is based in Santa Clara, California, is the world's largest chip maker. Where does it make all its chips?
We've got manufacturing facilities all around the world. A lot of the chip itself, are manufactured here in the United States. We had a major announcement last week where we expanded our New Mexico site, which is right outside of Albuquerque. We invested another $1 billion in that facility. We do some manufacturing here in Northern California, as well as Oregon, as another major manufacturing site here in the United States.
Now, we've got new manufacturing techniques underlying the Pentium, and we've got new architecture techniques. Does the chip look any different than the other chips?
Well, just by itself, not really. They're kind of effervescent looking. They're kind of nice looking.
The same size.
We actually have in the Museum of Modern Art in New York one of the posters of the 46 up there. So the lines are different or moved around a little bit. It's bigger, as I said, because it's got 3 million transistors instead of 1 million for the 486. But essentially doesn't look much different. Now, the package it's in is going to be a little bit bigger, too, because we've added some lines to get to the processor. So it's generally bigger, and that's all.
How big is it?
The chip itself or the package it's in?
With the whole package. When we're saying that, we've got the chip itself, then there are wires coming out so you can connect those. It's square. And
it's about an inch and a half square. It's a ceramic package it's in today. Now, as we go out in time, sometimes we put them in smaller packaging and plastic packaging as we cost reduce them. We did that with the 46 when we created the 46SX, where we took the math coprocessor off the 46 and we put it in plastic packaging, and that way we can cost reduce it. I would imagine, though I don't know, we'll do something to cost reduce the Pentium processor. So the actual package itself changes and there's different variations of it. The chip itself, though, will get smaller because, again, what we do in the semiconductor business is we shrink things. We make things smaller. And the current Pentium die will be shrunk later this year into next year so we can make more of them per wafer, as we say, and that'll be coming along. So the actual chip will get much smaller than what it is today.
Let's talk about the architecture of the Pentium chip for a bit.
Mm-hmm.
386 and 486 have a single execution unit, and we were talking about that, where you pull up an instruction from memory and you execute it, and then you pull up another one. The Pentium has two processors which work at the same time. Can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, let's talk about that a second. We went up to the 46 and going back and how we've changed the architecture. Going from the 46 to the Pentium processor, it's not exactly correct to say we have two processors in it.
Ah.
What we have is in the integer unit, where a lot of most programs today use integer operations, and if you remember back, whole numbers, right, back to your mathematics, whole numbers, and that's where most programs do their work. In that unit on the processor, we have two arithmetic logic units, or ALUs. Mm-hmm. So we have two of those, and we have what's called a pipelined architecture. Okay, actually the 486 implemented this, where if you can visualize, say, a pipeline and the instructions and data flow through the pipeline, and then they're manipulated and calculated and so on, so they come out of the pipeline differently than they come in, and that's how the adding or subtracting or multiplying or dividing is done. What we've done with the Pentium processor is now we've taken that one pipeline and added a second one. Okay, so fundamentally, it's very easy to think about that now we can get twice the performance out because I have two pipelines side by side, and you can get two instructions through at the same time. Now, that's theoretical. Of course, there's a lot of complication on top of that. How do you get to the theoretical limit?
You never quite double.
Well, you never quite double, but we've done a lot of things with the architecture to achieve, get as close as possible to that theoretical limit. And in reality, what you will see with the Pentium processor is you'll get more than one instruction per clock cycle. And that's a major breakthrough in microprocessor technology. This has been going on since the late 80s. People have been trying to achieve that, and a number of architectures have, and we've been able to bring this to the Intel PC architecture while maintaining all that software compatibility. That was the real thing, the trick to this whole thing. Without having to rewrite all your software or recompile it, get this kind of what we call super scalar performance, which means you get more than one instruction per clock and through the pipelines. So you get much higher performance without having to touch your software.
My guest today is John McIntyre. He is an architecture manager with Intel Corporation. We're talking about the new Pentium microprocessor. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. We were just talking about these two pipelines in the arithmetic logic unit, the arithmetic, you know, side by side. And certainly, if you can do two things at once, do the same thing at once, you're going to get improvement. I wanted to ask you about the pipeline. My familiarity with pipelines comes from those really big supercomputers, the big pipelines. And while we talk about if you're going to do, say, an add in one clock cycle, you bring up the instruction, it says add, you feed it to the add, you get your answer, you go along, that would be sort of a one stage. In the pipeline architectures that I'm familiar with, you go over and you look at your adding unit, the guy that adds, and you say, okay, if I look at this, over time I start here, here's sort of stage one, and I feed it to stage two, and maybe there's, let's say, five stages. I'm making up a number here. And the way the big supercomputers work is it says, gee, if you've got a whole bunch of adds to do in a row, put your first add in the first stage, and then when you're done with that, move it to the second stage. But that frees up the first stage. So the pipeline is put the second ad in the first stage. Pretty soon they're all following each other through.
Correct.
Is that the same kind of pipeline we're talking about here?
Same kind of pipeline, exactly. The pipeline used on the Intel 46 and in the Pentium processor is what we call a five-stage pipeline.
So I guessed.
You guessed it exactly right. You even got the number right. So while instructions are moving through the various stages, for instance, perhaps one instruction is actually going off to memory and getting the data and then manipulating the data. Another instruction can be fetched at a higher stage of the whole thing. So that is exactly the concept we've used. And you kind of hit upon what we're trying to do with the PC industry is growing up beyond just the desktop computer that we grew up with the 80s. We're trying to help corporate America do their big-time corporate computing that they used to have to do on a mainframe or maybe even a supercomputer, if they're a very high-end company doing maybe oil exploration or something. We're trying to borrow those technologies and move them down to the much more inexpensive microcomputer technology. So that's exactly what we're doing.
Now, one thing, I'm sort of stuck over here in architecture. I don't usually get to stay over here. There's something I saw in some of the information about the Pentium about branch prediction. Can you tell us about that?
Well, again, we're trying to fix the problem of, theoretically, we can do two instructions for every clock, okay? But there's a lot of things that happen in software that prevent that. For instance, if you have a branch, like if you have any programmers out there, you might recall this from college, you hit a point in the road in your program where it says if this or that, so on, and that's a branch. And if it jumps to somewhere else in the program, that leaves what we call a bubble in the pipeline, okay? It had to jump somewhere else in the program, so we can't fill that pipeline with the next instruction because it's waiting for another result or something like that.
We thought it was going to be the next instruction in line, and
right.
It's not.
No, because we had a branch, and we had to go off somewhere else and figure something else before we can come back and do this. Well, that knocks us off our theoretical limit because you can't be running both instructions at the same time at that point because you've got this bubble in the pipe. Well, this branch prediction unit, which is a hardware feature, actually kind of pays attention to how these branches are going and scoreboards it and predicts, I think it's going to branch to here so he can fill that bubble in the pipeline. And if it's right 80% of the time, hey, you're doing pretty good. And that's exactly what it's designed to do.
In the old days, and I mean the old days, when you were trying to optimize your own program, knowing that you might have to branch someplace else, you would put in line one after another the likely position of each likely and next instruction, and only for exceptions would you jump off to someplace else. Now we have some logic embedded in the processor to kind of help us look ahead and predict what's probably going to happen and hopefully grab some performance there.
Absolutely. The other important thing is compiler technology, because there are programs that take your application program and if you so-called recompile them, okay, you can compile the program to take advantage of this parallel nature of this program. So we've put a lot of time and investment into software at Intel. I mean, we're traditionally a hardware company, but because we're doing these superscalar designs, we've had to invest in our partners in the software community. And so there's compilers that will be available for the Pentium processor. So I said earlier, you can take your existing software, and it will run at much higher performance on a Pentium processor than, say, a 386 or 486. However, if you recompile it, you'll get even greater performance. So we've also done a lot with compiler technology.
Does Intel do any of that software technology, or do they have software partners? How does that all work?
Yeah, I alluded to our partners there. We do a lot of work ourselves kind of on the back end, as we say. We know how the Pentium processor works, obviously. So we design the software to understand that. But then we go out to the traditional compiler houses, the people who sell compilers on the market, and we work with them so they can incorporate our software technology into their products and bring it to market. So we don't want to be in the compiler business. That's not our business. But one of the problems we've had in the past is that the software always lags the hardware's capability. For instance, I mentioned the 386 was a 32-bit processor, and it came out in 1985. Most people today are still running 16-bit DOS code. So you're fundamentally not taking advantage of the hardware that's sitting there for you. And we've taken on a role to try to fix that by designing, helping the compiler community to catch up with us. And then there's also the application and the operating system community, the Unix people, Microsoft, of course, to design their operating systems to take better advantage of the processor power.
Now, I was going to ask you kind of a smarmy question here. I was going to say, how do we know your marketing department didn't get a hold of your board of directors and say, look, so stop with the numbers now. You know, you got to stop naming things numbers. And let's just take a right turn and give this new chip a name. We'll get a lot of PR out of it. No, it's kind of a smarmy thing to ask you, so I won't. Once you've explained that, you know, we can't protect the numbers. Do you think from now on that we're going to be seeing a lot more chips with names on them as opposed to numbers?
I think so. I mean, you're seeing that already. I think people in my industry, the semiconductor industry, are realizing that they have to communicate with the general public, not just our primary customer base, which is other engineering firms. So we need to make this stuff more understandable for everybody. After all, you know, PCs are prolific in society today. The much talked about home PC market, I think, is happening now. Small businesses use them. So definitely we see the need to use marketing to make this stuff more understandable.
When would a person on the street be able to walk into a computer store and a salesman will turn to them and say, you see this PC? It's got a Pentium chip in it.
Well, I think that's going to happen in May.
In May?
Yes.
That's fast.
Yeah, we're currently shipping Pentium processors to our customers, the system manufacturers. They're going to release their products in May. So we'll have, you'll be able to go into your computer store probably in the second quarter at least. I would imagine they'll have some stocking in May, and you'll be able to buy either a desktop or a server based on the Pentium processor. Now, pricing, again, is another issue. I can't talk to that because the system manufacturer prices it any way he chooses to, but they'll be there.
Moira's guest has been John McIntyre, an architecture manager for Intel Corporation. This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco Songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. If you'd like a cassette tape of this broadcast or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Special thanks for additional facilities at KERA-FM in Dallas, Texas. For Tech Nation, this is Mike Amatori. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.
This is Internet Talk Radio. You may copy these files and change the encoding format, but may not alter the content or resell the programs. You can send us mail to mail@radio.com. Internet Talk Radio. Same day service in a nanosecond world.